This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today, we'll be discussing ethics and health and in health and medicine, the first in a monthly mini-series that we will be using to explore various health ethics issues. Now, it may seem slightly esoteric to some of you. You may be wondering, do I really have to be concerned about ethics when it comes to healthcare issues? But here are some questions for you to think about that may actually make you realize how relatable these issues are to you. So perhaps you may come across a situation where a doctor has a romantic relationship with a patient, or if a doctor shares a patient's personal information with others apart from you, or if your doctor or hospital insists on giving you a treatment that you are refusing. So these are just some among the many ethical concerns in health and medicine that I think we will all come across at some point in our interactions with healthcare. So what we want to do in this first show today is to try and unpack the basics about ethics in healthcare and to understand why these ethical issues affect us all, whether it's on an individual basis or perhaps on a wider policymaking and public health basis. And my first guest in the series to help us understand these is Dr. Sharon Kaur Gumoh Singh, Senior Lecturer at the Faculty of Law at University of Malaya. How are you today, Sharon?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Very well as well. Thank you so much for your time. And I know this, I'm looking forward to what will, I'm sure, be a very interesting discussion. And I hope we'll be able to draw on, practical, relatable issues, to help all of you understand what exactly are we talking about when it comes to ethics in healthcare, why it should matter to us. But if you have any questions or any thoughts, opinions you'd like to share with us regarding some of the issues that we're going to discuss today, our lines are open, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us, 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. I think, first of all, Sharon, I have to ask the really newbie question. What exactly are ethics? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think especially in the context of, let's say, healthcare and medical care, when we talk about ethics, we're really talking about, what is the right thing to do? And it might seem quite easy, right? Because we all have this gut instinct about what is right and what is wrong. We feel that something is good or bad. But when we think about it in terms of ethics or ethical theories, they're actually arguments or principles that sort of help us to work through what are the right things to do in a particular situation. And because they're actually arguments that say you need to respect autonomy, for instance, and then we think about what is autonomy, we can then discuss it with each other. We can reflect, we can assess whether or not we're making the right decisions. So it's a little bit more than just saying, I feel that this is right. You're saying, I feel that this is right because this is a principle that I think is important and it applies in this situation because of these reasons. So they then provide us with a clearer guide to action.
All right.
So I think that's really what they are.
And coming back to where you say many of us have a gut instinct where we feel something, we should do something because it feels right. Now, that's perhaps related to certain values that we're brought up with. Moral values, as I'm sure, are instilled in us from a very young age, or even religious values. Are those different from the ethical principles you're talking about?
Yeah, not really. So I think they're pretty much building blocks, right? So we get our sense of what is right or what is wrong or what is important to us based on our cultures, on our religion, on our family values. But really what happens is, I think when we all come together, we're almost speaking a different language to each other, because I may have a different religion, you may come from a different culture. And when I'm trying to assert that this is the right thing to do, you may not really, not understand, but it may not resonate with you. Whereas I think ethical principles sort of give us a common language. So rather than I'm speaking French to you and you're speaking Hungarian to me, we both speak English to each other because we try and use the same bedrock of principles.
All right. And when we talk about ethics in health and healthcare, how is that different, or rather, how does it become more nuanced?
Yeah, so I think that is just thinking about what are the right things to do in a specific situation. So then we really think about what are the different types of situations that might arise in the context of delivering healthcare or in terms of healthcare in general. So we might think about different situations. So in some senses, there are interactions between doctors and patients. What are the right things to do there? In another sense, we think about how do we conduct research in medical research? What is the right thing to do it in medical research? And that's a little bit different, right? Because it's a different context. And we might also think about, like today, what has really become an issue is public health. How do we deal with the pandemic? What are the right things to do in this context? So again, we're just thinking about principles and values that maybe should guide our decision-making and our action, depending on the situations that we actually face.
So when it comes to healthcare and medicine, it would seem to me almost that surely at the end of the day, the guiding principle is to save lives, is not to bring harm to people. Is there anything that goes beyond that?
Because people are complicated and life is complex. So, it's saving life is always a good thing. Life is always better than death, right? But then sometimes you think about, well, what happens at the end of life, right? Who gets to choose whether or not I should have every single piece of chemotherapy if I feel that I've had enough and this is when my life should be enough for me? And when we talk about, well, we should just be doing good, but it's not so easy. What does it mean to do good? Who gets to decide what's good for me? So does a doctor get to decide that I should take these 5 chemotherapy sessions? And is that good because I might live another 1 year? Or do I get to decide that actually what's good for me is not throwing up every day? It's not losing my hair. I don't want to live for another year. I don't mind living for 6 months if I can walk about and spend that time with my family. So even, thinking about what is good is not always so simple. So sometimes you need to struggle to get to what is the right thing to do.
So that example you gave, and it's also similar to when I introduced our topic earlier today, if your healthcare provider insists that you must take a treatment, but, your values or your needs or your circumstances are just making you say, I'd rather not for whatever reasons they may be. So these are where ethical principles would be applied to help guide the decision in the patient's best interests, right? But then what does that look like? Who then takes us through whether it's asking certain questions to arrive at the decision, who makes the ultimate decision? So how does that still look like?
Yeah, so, and again, it's so context specific, right? It really depends on the situation, which is why, so doctors will be trained in medical ethics. And one of the things that they will be trained is that they will learn that it's very important to respect patients, that you must respect patients' autonomy, that, you and I, if we're able to make decisions and we understand the consequences, we should be able to say, no, I've had enough treatment and I don't want to continue. And, ethics would require that if I respect you as an individual and you have decided you don't want anything else, I should not give you any more treatment. And out of that comes the legal doctrine of informed consent, that, unless you consent to treatment, the doctor can't provide it to you. But of course, then, it sometimes it gets complicated, which is when you really start struggling, which is, are you making an independent decision? Are you autonomous? Are you able to make this decision? Are you in so much pain that you don't even understand what you're deciding? Mm. Or are you very young? And then who gets to decide for you? And then what does it mean to decide?
So where your mental capacity gets called into question.
Yes. And then if you have capacity or you don't, so even then, there's a whole sort of literature on how do you even decide whether somebody has capacity? What sort of tests should we use? And so if we think that autonomy and respecting people is really important, we try and use a test that maximizes your capacity. So we try and say, you know, it really depends on what decision you're making. So you may not have the capacity to decide on a really complex surgery if you're very ill, if you're very tired, or if you're suffering from some dementia. But you may be able to have the capacity to make a much more simple decision as to whether or not to treat an ingrown toenail. And so even how we decide on, you know, so it's all about respecting people and trying to really dig deep and understand how do we respect you. And even when you don't have capacity, should we think about, well, you know, you were a Muslim or you are a Muslim or you are a Buddhist. So we should treat you in a way that is respectful of that particular custom and culture, because when you did have capacity, these things were important to you. So, yeah, so when we think about things in terms of trying to do the right thing, we try and dig deep and really question how we should respond in a way that is principled and ethical.
So the flip side of that would be where treatment, and to continue with this example, is where treatment is delivered simply because you're following some sort of textbook, you know, prescribing method, and there is no conversation, there is no discussion with the patient to find out whether that's really in their best interest. Would that be right?
Yes, and that would be what we would call a very paternalistic view, where you are, you know, acting as a father and you're deciding for your patient. You're saying, you know, this is what is best for you, and we're just going to do it. We don't need to have a detailed conversation. I don't need to really think about what's important to you. But that's really, I think, changed over the last 10, 20 years. We don't see a lot of that anymore.
So then the question would be, what difference does it make to me as the patient or the person receiving the care if at the end of the day, the doctor isn't doing me, I mean, the doctor is trying to treat my condition, is trying to provide relief for me, whatever that form may take. How does the ethical decision-making process actually improve my life as the person receiving the care?
Yeah, well, it improves your life because, you know, the ethical principles, let's say typically in clinical care, right, you respect people, you protect their autonomy, you protect their confidences. You mentioned confidentiality at some point. You try and help them, and you try not to harm them. So it makes all the difference because you're not just treated as just another body in a bed that is just a conglomeration of symptoms that you just apply, as you said, the textbook, you know, response. But you're a human being and somebody cares about what you think. And somebody talks to you. So because, you know, it's one of the most profound things that you can ever experience, right? Needing help with your health. Without health, we have nothing. And being treated as a human being and being respected. And I think it makes all the difference in the world in how you experience it, how your family experiences it as well.
All right. I'm speaking to Dr. Sharon Kaur Gumuk Singh, Senior Lecturer at the Faculty of Law in University of Malaya, and we are discussing ethics in health and medicine and why it matters to you. This is the first in a monthly mini-series that we're doing to explore various issues under health ethics. If you have questions, if you'd like to sort of share some of your experiences, you know, in your interactions with healthcare and where you think ethics may have you know, been crucial to it, or where you thought maybe there was lack in ethical decision making or ethical care, do share them with us. 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll go for a quick break, and when we come back, maybe Sharon, you can just share some examples of how research ethics, you know, what it looks like, because I know that's one of your focus areas. So we'll explore that when we come back on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today we're discussing ethics in health and medicine and why it's important for healthcare providers, for healthcare workers, clinicians, and also medical researchers to have this ethical, framework in mind, to have an ethical lens in the way that they, look at the issues in their work and to the way that their work is carried out as well. I'm speaking to Dr. Sharon Kaur Gumuk Singh, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at University of Malaya. If you have questions or thoughts you'd like to share with us, you can call us at 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Now, Sharon, perhaps a little bit about research ethics. You said that's also one of the areas where ethical principles are important. Perhaps you'd explain a little bit more to us?
Yeah, sure. And I think really the, just to get a little bit geeky at this point, if that's okay, the real advent of modern bioethics and medical ethics really finds its root in research ethics. That's where it started, with things like the World War II German scientific trials that were run during World War II by the Nazis. And people were thinking, oh my goodness, how can human beings do such terrible things to each other? And following that, there were a number of exposés in the US where, scientists and respected doctors were actually running trials on people in institutions, on children, mm-hmm. on old people. And they weren't mean, they weren't horrible. They were trying to achieve really good ends. They were trying to understand syphilis. They were trying to treat, understand hepatitis. But the ways in which they carried out these experiments, because they were so close to the science and what they wanted to achieve, just seemed to be wrong. And as a result of which, you had these different declarations and different ways of protecting people from research. And so that's really a big sort of area of bioethics, where you look at when people carry out research, because ultimately the aim of research is to generate knowledge that can help everybody. But you want to make sure that the people who become subjects or who participate in mm-hmm. research, that they're protected. You want to make sure they understand what they're getting into, so that their informed consent is obtained. You want to make sure that somebody has looked at the risks and benefit profile, that you're not asking them to take on too much risks, because some of these trials are really complicated and you can't expect people like you and me to understand the actual risks. So we then say, well, we need to have an independent ethics review of all these protocols. Sometimes you want to think that this research needs to have social value. You can't just do whatever is that you think might be interesting, because there's a cost that goes into research. So there are all these different, and you want to think about justice. How are you selecting participants? Mm-hmm. And an interesting area, which I think is coming to the fore, and even now in terms of some of the COVID research that is done, is that for many, many years, a lot of research excluded pregnant women, because, pharmaceutical companies or sponsors were afraid that if anything happened to the fetus, they would be liable for any sort of damage. And as a result of which, you will find that there are very few drugs that are actually approved for use in pregnant women, because very few studies have been carried out. And so recently, over the last 5 years, there's been this call to say that when you run trials, you need to be fair, that you need to be just when you're selecting your participants. You need to include pregnant women. You need to do trials on children, because otherwise we don't know what's a safe dosage for them. So yeah, research ethics is really interesting.
That's really fascinating, because my first instinct would be, well, in a trial, it's experimental, isn't it? So I would think we want to protect pregnant women, we want to protect children, so that they're not exposed to something where we don't know fully the impact of it yet. So then, when you have a full and robust ethical view of it, does that mean that, so right now the motivation for excluding them is so that those organizing the trials or looking at these particular drugs or medications won't be held liable if harm should happen, but So what you're saying is that there hasn't been enough of a robust ethical discussion, do you think?
Yeah, so I think that it's not so much that there isn't a robust ethical discussion, but I think, so we're balancing all these different things, right? So mm-hmm. we're saying it needs to be safe, right? Mm-hmm. There needs to be a risk benefit. And so it is possible if you're careful and you do, you know, let's say phase one and phase two trials, you're doing animal trials that sort of establish some level of safety in women, that then excluding them maybe becomes unfair because you don't have enough data to be able to offer them these medications mm. safely. So it's, yeah, so it's just this balancing act. And sometimes fear of litigation sometimes comes to the fore. And then you might say, yeah, well, okay, but, you know, if you can balance that and you can just do it as safely as possible, this other thing, which is justice, is really something that we need to address because that's becoming really important now and people are getting left behind.
All right. You know what? We have a caller on the line with a question, so I'm going to switch over to that right now. Hi, Katrina.
Hi.
Good afternoon. I think you have a question for us.
Yes. Hi, good afternoon. I have a question in regards to the role of medical ethics and systems of incarceration. So I'm thinking in particular, for example, about judicial caning or whipping, as it happens in Malaysia for immigration offences and others. I've read that the there's a role in which medical officers kind of check that a detainee is fit to be whipped, for lack of better phrasing. Now, kind of given that, you know, human rights groups have said that the kind of caning that happens here is tantamount to torture, I wonder what is the role then of medical ethics or something like that. Similarly, or in addition to that, thinking about the kind of healthcare in places of detention, in prisons or immigration, you know, whether it's of women and pregnant women, but also just general healthcare, you know, and of course, bearing in mind the pandemic. So sort of broad questions about where's the role of healthcare, healthcare providers, and how we think about ethics in these contexts.
All right. Thank you so much, Katrina. We'll address it on air.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any thoughts on that, Sharon? Heavy ones.
Yeah, thanks for starting with an easy question. No, that's really a great question. And it really, really is a difficult issue, right? Because there are conventions that say that doctors and healthcare professionals really just should not be involved or be in any way connected with torture or penal activities, and there are situations in which doctors will refuse to go into prisons to treat. They will refuse to be part of this. And so if a prisoner is hurt, there is some literature that says actually that the prisoners should be taken into the hospitals, not that the doctors should go into the prisons, because that becomes part of the system. But then again, it's very hard, right? Because if you're in a system where your employer requires you to do so, having you there is actually safer than not having you there. Again, it becomes very difficult. And I know that this is something that the Malaysian Medical Association and the MMC really have been lobbying the government, saying it's just not appropriate for doctors to be in that position and that you're putting them in a really, really difficult position. So I would agree that, you know, when you're carrying out these things, you shouldn't really be expecting doctors to say, okay, he's healthy enough, now you can cane him or you can whip him and you can hurt him, because that really does go against the grain of your training. So that's really tough. And I think it becomes even more difficult when it comes to treatment and access to care for refugees and migrant workers in this country. And I know that it really is a source of moral distress for a lot of healthcare providers. And, you know, because if we think about it from a purely ethical point of view, everybody should have a right to healthcare, and everybody should have access to adequate healthcare, regardless of your race, your religion, whether or not you're legal or you're illegal. And sometimes it becomes almost impossible because of financial reasons, because of policy reasons, and really, what then is the duty of the doctor? And I remember I attended a conference or a workshop that we were talking about these sort of things, and whether or not, you know, should doctors actually be advocates in this situation? Should they take on this mantle of trying to promote social justice? And yeah, I think you know, I think it's important. I think it's important for all of us to recognize the value of providing access to healthcare for everybody. And it's not a good thing if we have like two different systems for different populations, and it's a matter of justice.
Mm. So here is where the ethical framework, you know, having ethical principles underscore the policies and the decisions. I guess that would make policy decisions more objective in that sense. It wouldn't be about my value versus your value. It would be about these principles that are inalienable.
I mean, absolutely, right? So it becomes something that we can actually talk about. And so, you know, it becomes something that doctors can go to the prison wardens or to the authorities and say, look, part of our ethical principles is do no harm. And if we're actually saying that people should are well enough to be caned, we're actually doing harm to them. And we can't, you know, it goes. And so then it gives you at least a ground for arguing against or for different policies. Similarly, in relation to, you know, providing access to healthcare for everybody, these principles give us almost like the tools to build our arguments, to develop good policy. And
So having those ethical tools and the sort of almost like a basis for argument is one thing. Of course, the other thing is actually having the discussions that move policy along. And that's probably another discussion for another day. But just very quickly, before we go for our next break, all of these deliberations that goes into making what is finally or what should finally be an ethical decision requires, as you said, a person to dig deep, a physician to really explore, to have long discussions, for researchers to look at all possibilities and all stakeholders, for instance. Now, would it be seen as cumbersome that this is taking too much effort? I have an objective in mind. Why don't I just work towards that? You know, I guess if I were a physician or a clinician who's not inclined to look at ethics, how would you convince me?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think as a physician, you really have very little choice because you're actually regulated by the Malaysian Medical Council, and the Malaysian Medical Council actually prescribes a code of professional conduct, which is made up of, you know, the ethical things that you are meant to do. So you're meant to get informed consent. You're meant to ensure that, you know, confidences are maintained. You're not supposed to sleep with your patients, something that you referred to earlier. And if you actually violate these ethical codes, you can be brought up to the Malaysian Medical Council and disciplinary action can be taken against you. So I think in the profession, it's no longer an option to be unethical in these regards. And I think, yeah, you know, sometimes the arguments can become very complicated and complex, and it's impossible for everybody to continuously think about what is the right thing to do in this situation. And this is why you have general guidelines and codes where people in your profession have already thought about, generally in these situations, this is a good way to conduct yourself. And unless you actually come across a really exceptional situation that's really, really difficult, more often than not, just following these codes of conduct and being led by them is already a good way to ensure that you're acting ethically.
And what if you come across those extraordinary situations where your existing tools can't help you?
Well, that's a great question. So again, if you're thinking about it in terms of let's say, clinical issues, right? What a lot of countries now have developed, and I think it's starting in Malaysia, they actually have clinical ethics consultation services or committees. So if you work in a hospital, you can actually send a query to this committee that will be made up usually of senior clinicians and maybe a bioethicist and somebody from social work. And they will look through this and help you work through it as an independent body who maybe looks at it from you know, these sort of principal areas and they think through it with you to maybe offer you some assistance in thinking about these issues in a more complete way when it comes to tricky things.
All right. Now we'll go for a quick break. And when we come back, you've already alluded to the fact that this pandemic has in itself offered so many issues when it comes to thinking about ethics. Perhaps we could look a little bit at what some of those issues might be, vaccination and how it's being prioritized or how it's being procured by countries across the world, or even, you know, something that I think a lot of doctors and frontliners, especially in the public healthcare system, are grappling with right now, with ICUs being overwhelmed, deciding who gets ICU care, and how would ethical principles help to alleviate the burden of decision making or to make the decision making process clearer for them. I just want to try and see what might be some of the thinking there. So if you have any questions or thoughts you'd like to share with us, 03-7733-2900 is the number to call, or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. I'm speaking to Dr. Sharon Kaur Gumuk Singh, Senior Lecturer at the Faculty of Law in University of Malaya. We'll be right back on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. My guest today, Dr. Sharon Kaur Gumuk Singh, Senior Lecturer at the Faculty of Law in University of Malaya. We're having a really interesting discussion about ethics in health and medicine, some different areas where ethical principles or ethical dilemmas may present themselves in clinical practice between doctors and patients, in research, when you're conducting research, when you're choosing people to do that research on, what kinds of ethical principles do you need to take into consideration? There are many other areas as well, and we'll actually be exploring some of these separately and in more in-depth in our monthly mini-series. So do keep an ear out for our show every month where we will explore each of these areas of health ethics. If you have any calls, if you have any thoughts or questions, you can call us at 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Just very quickly, I wanted to find out from you, Sharon, about what kinds of ethical issues have come to the forefront during this pandemic. What has really stood out for you?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think so many things at so many different levels. I think in terms of the individual doctor-patient relationships, how doctors manage, as you mentioned, when you have limited resources in the beginning of the pandemic with the PPE, you know, how you even distribute that. And now, because the numbers are going up so quickly, whether or not they're actually going to have to be rationing treatment and rationing ICU beds, how non-COVID-19 patients may have their treatments deferred, how do you actually, you know, how are you going to be just to everybody? And that's really difficult in terms of just the provision of healthcare. And at a high level, you know, how do you manage the tension between public health interests and individual interests? And really with the rolling out of vaccines. And I think one of the things that's really struck me as being important is this notion of trust and trustworthiness. And it seems to me that for some reason, you know, over the last maybe 20, 30 years, there's been a great deal of loss of trust. And I'm not just necessarily talking about nationally, right? I think the public have lost their trust in science, right? People are just so skeptical and they believe all sorts of different things. People, to a certain extent, have lost their trust in healthcare providers. People certainly have lost their trust in policymakers and what they're deciding. And I think that's become really difficult, because once you lose the public and you lose this sense of trust and they don't feel that you're trustworthy, it becomes really, really difficult to then do anything, you know, because you can't do research without the public taking part in research. You can't have a public health measure without the public actively taking part in the vaccination programs or doing social distancing in a meaningful way. So I think that's really something that struck me, that, and I think that goes back to ethics again, right? So if you do something and if you say that these are the principles that we're doing, and we're being transparent and we're being accountable and we're talking to you, that builds trust. And I think that's something that that takes a long time to rebuild. But I think that's what we should be looking to doing is, and I think that's why it's really important to really have a principled approach. And if you think about the pandemic, one of the, you know, one of the hallmarks of COVID-19 is how different classes of people have been treated so differently, right? How the marginalized and the poor who are unable to socially distance are catching it at a greater rate. How, because of socioeconomic disparities, they may already be suffering from comorbidities, they may be diabetic, they may have hypertension. So they're getting sicker in larger numbers, and they're dying in larger numbers. And even when we're thinking about, so when we're thinking about responses, like how we roll out the vaccine program, I think it's really important to be very clear what we're trying to achieve, what are the principles behind what we're trying to achieve, to be transparent about it, to be accountable, to recognize that where there is vulnerability, where there is sort of a marginalization, that we lift up these people, you know, even more because they are suffering more than everybody else in this pandemic. So I think that's really
And that's equity, isn't it? Where you recognize certain groups are more marginalized and you raise them up to a level playing field. Now, there's something that has struck me intensely, especially as the numbers have risen dramatically in the last few weeks, is all this talk about how ICU resources are becoming scarce and the frontliners are really crying out in despair because the decisions of who to put on ICU comes down to them. And I read a commentator who said that ethical tools here are really important because that will protect, or that will take the psychological burden of decision-making away from the frontline, or away from individual frontliners. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, right. It really helps to have a guideline to help you think through it. And, you know, one of the, I can't say good things, but yeah, I think one of the good things that has come out of this pandemic, at least for the bioethics community, is that for the first time, right, a number of my friends and some colleagues, they've come together to form what is called the Malaysian Bioethics Community. And right at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, and a lot of these people were clinicians who were working during the day, and at night they were meeting up, and they've actually drawn up these sort of clinical ethics guidelines to do exactly this, right? They're intensivists who have said, you know, these are things you should be thinking about if you need to allocate ICU beds. There is some thinking in some of the literature where even who makes these decisions maybe shouldn't be the doctors who are actually treating the patients in the ICU, because that's really hard. So maybe you have a triaging committee that works, and they decide who, you know, should be put into the ICU or not put into the ICU. But yeah, these are heartbreaking decisions. And I can genuinely tell you that, you know, our doctors are really going all flat out to not have to say you can't have an ICU bed if you need it. Mm-hmm. And
Are these guidelines available that have been drawn up by the Bioethics Committee?
On the community, yes, they are available. I shall send them to you, and maybe you can post them on your
perhaps we can provide a link to it in our podcast.
Yeah. So they're freely available. And
all right. Now, coming back to what we're discussing today, and especially equipping, you know, healthcare workers and providers with the skills needed to understand ethical issues. Now, what kind of training do health professionals need?
Yeah, so, you know, I think a lot of people will actually develop a sense of this over time, you know, especially if you're thinking about clinical ethics. As you practice more and more, you see more and more things, and you develop an understanding and a feeling for it. But it's always really good to be able to think about these things apart from your actual practice, and to think about the principles and the ways and the theories in which you can look at it. And these are available at different levels. So there are a few places where you can actually get like a master's in medical ethics and medical law. I think UITM runs a little program, as well as Taylor's College, and not so much in the country. There's Singapore that runs a program, and Hong Kong University. But what we do have at the University of Malaya, which is new and it's an amazing program, is the Masters of Health Research Ethics. And this is actually a project funded by the National Institutes of Health, the American Institutes of Health. And it's a collaboration between the University of Malaya and Johns Hopkins University, where they've put together this great program for people to learn about health research ethics. And it's just such a well put together program. And we've had two cohorts. So this is our second cohort, and they're great students, and they've all got scholarships. So I think under the research project, there's a certain number of scholarships available to do this. And so I think that there is the beginning of a bioethics training in Malaysia, and hopefully that will extend and more people will start courses and develop training modules.
And who would this be relevant to? Not just doctors, right? Not just physicians.
Yeah, it would be relevant to anybody who's interested in ethics, right? So you could be a physician, you could be a lawyer, you could be a philosopher, you could be a social scientist, you could be a healthcare worker. Because, you know, it's just so broad, and you know, medical ethics and health ethics and research ethics covers a huge variety of stuff, all the way from your typical clinical trials to some of this really cutting-edge genomic research and AI research and data-driven research and biobanking. That there's space for everybody, and it's an amazing thing.
All right. So that's the Masters of Health Research Ethics at University of Malaya. That's really interesting. Now, maybe just a final message, Sharon, on what we've been discussing today as an overview of why ethics in health and medicine are important.
Yeah, I think it's really important because of, I think, this notion of trust and trustworthiness. You know, I think that it's so important that you and I, as members of the public, can trust the healthcare system, can trust the scientists that are doing research, can trust the doctors that are treating us to genuinely do what is the right thing most of the time, to be principled about what they're doing, to be transparent, to be accountable. Because then everything works if everybody trusts in the system, and if you know, people are making decisions based on principles and not just, as you mentioned earlier, on what you intuitively feel is right or wrong. Mm. Because it may be right for you, it may not necessarily be right for the other person.
All right. Thank you so much, Sharon. I've been speaking to Dr. Sharon Kaur Gurmukh Singh, Senior Lecturer from the Faculty of Law, University of Malaya, about ethics in health and medicine. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.